As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and as F1 heads to Melbourne, all eyes will be on home heroes Oscar Piastri and Daniel Ricciardo. But has the McLaren driver become the main man for the home fans, and what should we expect from the race at Albert Park? I'm Ed Straw, and joining me are Mark Hughes and our very own home hero, Michael Laminato. Well, Michael, welcome back. Of course, Michael from Fox Sports Australia and various podcasts you may have heard. Home race. Great source of excitement.
Yes, home hero as well. I don't know how to respond to that kind of introduction, but welcome back to Australia. It's good to have you here. And it is very exciting. Another sold-out Grand Prix for Melbourne. People are up and about, as one might say down here, and we're looking forward to seeing how it goes.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great event to come to, and we'll get on to talking about the event a little more in a moment. And Mark Hughes, how are you doing? You've been doing a lot of cycling.
Yeah, I've been here a few days. It's my spiritual home. I love it here. They just won't let me in permanently. So, I just come out a little bit early and leave a little bit late for this one.
Excellent. It's good to get some wheel work in. But yeah, it's a great event to be at. And yeah, I've not done Australia the past few years. In fact, the last Australian Grand Prix I did was the COVID year when everything went really strange.
Oh, no.
And actually, one of the last normal days before that was recording a podcast with you, Michael, and Lawrence Barreto. And then me and Lawrence went to the women's T20 final at the MCG, and then shortly after the world went mad. I don't know if they're directly connected. But.
Fingers crossed this time, then.
Yes, you're banned from the MCG now, I think, aren't you? As a result.
Absolutely. Well, English cricket fans have never been that welcome at the MCG, but no, it's a great ground, I have to say. I'm pleased to have been able to have been there. But we're here to talk about motorsport, not cricket. So, Michael, you bring special expertise because you're a Melbourne resident. How big a deal is the Grand Prix for Melbourne? Is it a really huge focal point, or is it just another event that happens in the city? Because it's quite difficult to tell as an outsider, because it seems like the centre of the world when you're here. But all Grand Prix seem like that because we're covering F1. So is this a huge deal for Melbourne?
Yeah, it's an interesting question as well, because it's changed. I think if you'd been here before your infamous MCG run in that triggered the pandemic, the answer would have been really quite different when the audiences were a little bit down. And it really did feel like the Australian Grand Prix was just one of the events that Melbourne hosted after the tennis and whatever else. Since the pandemic, that has really changed. The sold-out audiences, we all sort of know, 400,000 in excess. This year, they'll expect even more. And it has really become a defining event on the city's events calendar. Melbourne really prides itself on being a major events city. As the former CEO, Andrew Westacott, used to say, well, we don't have a Harbour Bridge or an Opera House or the things people think of in Australia, but we do buy these events in and host them really well. Now it feels really different. I think that's also kind of interesting because since Melbourne got the Grand Prix in 96, the population here has increased by 2 million people. But in the last few years, it's felt like the event has grown greater in stature. People can't get tickets, all that kind of thing. So I think it's actually swung back the other way around. It feels like Melbourne is back on board in a really holistic sense, I guess, with the Grand Prix.
That's interesting insight there. Mark, you've been coming to Melbourne a bit longer than I have. I think my first Australian Grand Prix here was 2009. You'd have been here maybe 8 or 9 years earlier. Yeah. So has it changed from your perspective?
The event itself is very similar. It still has that lovely sort of garden party feel, and based around the parkland. So when you're on inside, it feels like it's always felt, just a lovely place to be. You can see the place around it developing over the years, but it hasn't changed in character, not that I've noticed.
That's an interesting point, the area around it. Perhaps, Michael, you can give listeners a bit more of an impression of it, because obviously everyone will be very familiar with the TV view of it. You've got the skylines of Melbourne in the background, but it's a little bit outside the centre, isn't it? Obviously, it's the St Kilda area. So perhaps you can give people a bit of an idea of how it really connects to the rest of the city.
Yeah, so it's south of the river. Like most cities, the river divides a lot of Melbourne in the trendy south. I'm from the south, so I'm going to back up my part of the world. But it's changed a little bit, I guess, in the time since the race has come, because directly opposite the river was most warehouses not that long ago, and as that's been developed with increasingly tall apartment towers and that kind of thing, it's had a knock-on effect between the river and where Albert Park is. So it's become, I guess, more valuable. There are more people in that living in that area when it may previously have been mostly offices. It's an extremely valuable part of the city. I'll never buy a house there, maybe never buy a house anywhere in Melbourne. So that part of it's changed as well, and I guess public transport's improved and all that kind of thing. So the vibe around as you exit Albert Park, I suppose, has also changed in that way.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one, because obviously those who were around when the race started, we were all very aware, certainly in Europe, about the opposition to the race, and there was all the Save Albert Park stuff going on. Is there still any sort of undertone of hostility to this is all a little bit awkward? Because it does actually use real roads, even though it's a parkland circuit, that is actually a normal road that people use.
Yeah, people will be seeing signs around Lakeside Drive is closed, and then shaking their fists at them as they're stuck in traffic inevitably at 9 a.m. as they try to get to work. The opposition still exists. The Save Albert Park group is still around, and annually will make their point that it is a public park that's closed for, I think, around about 2 weeks to set up and take down the circuit, and obviously for the Grand Prix itself. But in the last few years, as I was sort of saying, that has notably decreased in volume, or rather, I guess the support has increased dramatically in volume. I think a really good example is that before the pandemic, the state government was underwriting the race by, it was around about $50 million Australian. In the last year, that has increased to around about $100 million. But you don't hear a lot about the controversy of the state government spending all that money on Formula One anymore, because the event is so well supported. So the little hook for the opposition, which was this is a lot of money to be spending on a motor race, is no longer cutting through like it used to. It'll be interesting to see, and this is more of a global thing, as Formula One may plateau, or perhaps even if the bubble were to burst, if that were to come back. But at the moment in Melbourne, I mean, tickets are really hot. Friday sold out for the first time, as I understand it. It feels like it's only getting bigger.
Yeah, and it's also a big event because Thursday's always a track day as well. There's a big undercard of races here. So it's a big event from that perspective. It's not just F1. Mm. There's always a lot going on at this race.
Yeah, it's interesting as well, I suppose, because the supercars, which is our biggest domestic racing category, is being pushed down the order in the last few years since Formula 2 and Formula 3 have arrived. A decision that surprised me, to be totally honest. A long way to come for a Formula 2 and Formula 3 race. The supercars have now been kicked out of pit lane this year, so they're operating in the infield in pop-up tents, like you might see some other support categories at different races. Their races are kind of compromised too. They can have no pit stops because they have no meaningful access to pit lane. And that's caused a little bit of controversy among domestic racing fans. But I'm sort of interested in your opinions, actually, in terms of how Formula One's boom has influenced other racing categories around the world. I think there was an implication once that as Formula One grows, sort of rises all boats. But it doesn't feel like that. It feels like Formula One's so big, it's actually pushing some other categories to the fringes.
It sounds like economic trickle-down theory,
yeah,
doesn't it?
We know how that works. Yeah, it does. I think it's tended to bleed out the profile of other series more than it's lifted them up.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem with Formula One, isn't it? Because it sort of becomes motor racing, by which I mean motor racing means Formula One to people and everything else gets marginalised, which is frustrating because it's great and there's a great history for Grand Prix racing. But I think that's been a general trend long before this current boom. That's only a few years. But I guess with the rise in television, certainly looking at it from a UK perspective, and this reflects quite a few countries, I think, the rise of that through the 80s and 90s, and it did just sap interest from a lot of other things, didn't it, Mark? It's a bit of a shame in many ways, but I guess you can only have one premier tier of any particular type of sport because there's only so much time and so many eyeballs.
Yeah, but I do think putting the supercars into a field rather than the pit lanes is going to probably a bit of a stretch too far. You know, that's the country's premier racing series, and there'll be a lot of local interest in that. It's an event within itself. So, But I guess that's how it is.
yeah, and it is a brilliant championship as well. So it's a huge deal here in Australia. Is it still a non-championship round? Or
no, it's changed? Been a championship since 2018, I think, since the broadcasting. It all was television then, since they sort of came together. It's been a championship round, which is the more controversial element. We're the same amount of points as every other race, but they're only doing between 80 and 100 Ks each day and no pit stops and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's certainly a great championship and well worth watching if you can, I must admit. As I probably just revealed, I've not watched it perhaps as much as I should have done in recent years. And Bathurst always seems to clash with something, which is a shame because that's obviously the great race. But it does show also that motorsport in Australia is in a pretty good place, isn't it? Because you've got the Supercars Championship that gets so much attention. There's other big races. There's a good GT racing scene. There has been for quite a while here, isn't it? Obviously, the Bathurst sports car race as well earlier in the year is a huge deal. So Australia, which has always been a bit of a hotbed of motorsport, really is thriving in that regard, or at least it looks like that from afar.
I think certainly you're right. The international Bathurst races, the 12 and the 6 hour, have grown in stature in recent years. I couldn't tell you the history of it per se, but it does feel like that. The Supercars, I think, is in a more interesting place because it's sort of suffering a little bit MotoGP syndrome. In the last few years, MotoGP lost a lot of its big riders, and it felt like a bit of the heat came out of the championship because maybe not enough work had been done developing the identities of the next generation. And I feel like Supercars in a little bit of a similar position in the last few years, or it's a few more years than that, I suppose, between Jamie Wincup, Scott McLaughlin, Shane Van Gisbergen have all departed the series. We've also lost the traditional Holden versus Ford rivalry because Holden does not exist, course, and Ford does not make cars here anymore. It feels like a little bit of the heat has gone out of the series for that reason as well, and the sport's now trying to catch up by developing those next identities because there's a great crop of young drivers who are fighting for the title this year. And then there's also the background of the championship winner last year has broken up with his team for undisclosed reasons and not competing, and the team's not saying a lot and they've lost a lot of sponsors. So there's its own controversy there. But I think it can be in a good place, but there's a little bit of work to do to bring at least the supercars up to the standard, I guess, it should be in terms of the size of its influence on Australian motorsport.
Yeah, it's an interesting one as well, because also that championship, even in the sort of boom times, has been trying to expand outside of Australia, and it's really difficult. And we see this all around the world with domestic series. There's always this desire for growth, but they are domestic series, and that's kind of why they're successful. So, yeah, it'd be interesting to see the supercars this weekend. But it's also, I always like pointing out, because there's this great history of the Australian Grand Prix, isn't there, Mark, that people forget about. And obviously Albert Park is thought of as a new circuit for 96 when the Australian Grand Prix went there. But, of course, the Australian Grand Prix had been there many decades before as well. I think the track ran roughly the other way around.
Ran the other way around, yeah.
So there's a great history here as well.
There is, and a great history of top Europeans coming over and competing against the locals here. And that was, you know, the later developed into the Tasman series. And, the Europeans would come at in our winter and the summer here, with the cars that had been racing all season, and then they'd sell them to the locals, and rather than ship them all back. And so you had this, there was a relationship between, the direct relationship between the two scenes, even though they're other sides of the planet, and it's still quite strong, I think.
Yeah, very lucrative as well for some of the European manufacturers who bring over cars and often sell them over here. And yeah, some very interesting car driver combinations in that era, particularly sort of 50s and 60s that would crop up here. And yeah, that history of the Australian Grand Prix I always like, because there's often forgotten that someone like Roberto Moreno, I think, won the Australian Grand Prix three times.
You're going 80s. I was thinking 50s, but yeah, there was the Formula Atlantic cars which ran at the Australian Grand Prix.
And Alan Jones, of course, won at Calder in the Williams. That was a rather outgunned performance, as there weren't many F1 cars.
I think there was only one other. It was Bruno Giacomelli. And I think the rest of it was Formula 5000.
Yeah, D.A. Prony, I think, did well in that one. Are you much of a historian of Australian motorsport?
I like listening to it, though. I'm appreciating being a listener to the podcast right now.
That's a good test, isn't it, of whether what we're talking about is interesting. But I do like it because, again, connected to the rise of F1, there is this tendency for history to be eradicated a little bit. It's a bit the same with football, with the Premier League in England, in that it's almost like football started in 1992 is the joke. Mm-hmm. And it's like Grand Prix racing started in Australia in 1985 almost, when of course it didn't. So I enjoy pointing that out. But there's a lot of talk about this race and other pretenders to the throne of hosting the Australian Grand Prix, if you can call it that. Do you take many of those things seriously, or do you think Melbourne is absolutely locked in for the foreseeable?
Well, I think, well, at least contractually it is, although people might be aware, at least in the Commonwealth countries, that Victoria did break its contract to host the Commonwealth Games in a couple, well, would have been a couple of years, although I know no one's taken up that offer, so not quite exactly the same thing. There's always the threat of Sydney, mostly because the Melbourne-Sydney rivalry is one of those classic AB city rivalries in any city, as much as Australia would love to say it's unique. It really isn't. And the Sydney threat at the previous round of negotiations did seem quite serious, but as I understand it, sort of Formula One was turned up in Sydney and they were wined and dined and whatever, and then taken out to the far reaches of the western suburbs where a permanent circuit might have been built, and doesn't really sell the Sydney dream of the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge in the background. A street circuit, I mean, you never say never, I suppose, because sometimes street circuits have come up of nowhere and worked, but the idea of closing down any streets around the Sydney Harbour, which are absolute arterials, is unfathomable. I don't live in Sydney, so maybe someone from Sydney will be saying, of course you could, but it seems unlikely, and at least for this foreseeable future, it does feel like it's in Melbourne. And it's the thing where it's the longer it's here, although I guess Barcelona could argue that's not necessarily the case, but the longer the race is here, the more it feels like it belongs here. Sorry to the people in Adelaide listening, but I feel like that's where we're at the moment.
Yeah, of course, Adelaide was a great event. I went to the Clipsal, the supercars race. It's about 2009 now, so some time ago, but that was a great event. And probably it's the second most fully integrated to the area race I've ever been to after Le Mans, actually, because Adelaide's a pretty small city. So you can walk from the centre to the track really, really quickly. So it really felt like a big event. Melbourne's got a bit of a feel for that as well. And of course, we had the Adelaide Motorsport Festival you may have seen at the weekend, Mark. Not that you were there. I was aspiring to go there had I got out to Australia earlier, as I was originally planning, but I couldn't do. Valtteri Bottas was there, all sorts of interesting old cars. So I guess it's good Adelaide lives on in that regard.
Yeah, and there was, I think, a nice little demonstration, wasn't there? Somebody drove a Leighton House around there.
Yeah, Valtteri Bottas, I think.
That was Bottas, yeah. Yeah, I watched a little bit of footage of that. It was great to hear it and hear the downshifts echoing off the walls and stuff. I'm sure it would have been a very, quite emotional if you were there to see it, if you'd seen it the first time around.
And the Adelaide 500 still ends the supercars calendar, so they kind of get two doses of that. And that's still a similar event, really quite large and popular there, as I understand it. So you still can go to Adelaide for different reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the Motorsport Festival looks like it's an event that's growing as well, and well worth people checking out if you're coming out for the Grand Prix next year. Because Australian Grand Prix is going to open the season, I think, is the plan. I
believe so.
Next year. We haven't got a confirmed calendar, but it seems to be. So that could be quite a good double bill. And obviously, it's not that far from Adelaide to Melbourne, although not that far in Australia is very much a relative term.
You can drive. It's about 9 hours, I think, so not terrible. Yeah, as I understand it, first race of the season will be the first between Adelaide and Melbourne, I think, be the first two weekends of March, is what I'm hearing anyway.
Excellent. What a doubleheader. I'll have to try and get out for that next year. But yeah, Australia certainly knows how to put on a motor race, and that's why we're looking forward to the race this weekend.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first, a word about our partner, Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done, and Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Well, let's get on to a few more specific topics now, Mark. For obvious reasons, we're going to talk about Oscar Piastri. He's the main hope for home fans this weekend, of course. What do you make of his progress in the early stages of his second season?
Yeah, it's been okay. I mean, obviously, it's tied in with the level of competitiveness of the McLaren, which has probably been a little bit underwhelming for those who were watching how excitingly quick that car became. Sort of latter half of last year, so far that car's not been as quick as that. So he can only compete at the level of your car. In terms of his competitiveness, if you take his teammate Lando Norris as the barometer, he's doing fine. He was probably not underlying as quick as Norris in Bahrain, but Bahrain's a tricky place with the setup in terms of protecting the tyres, and this is the one thing he's very much focused on this year, is getting his head around how you have to treat the tyres, and that's not the same from one circuit to another, and Bahrain is at the extreme end of that tyre management. He did okay. He managed the tyres well. If Lando had put his lap together in qualifying, it would have been significantly quicker. But as it was about the same as Oscar's. They were close together in the race. But then it came to Jeddah, and he was the lead McLaren pretty much all weekend. And not by much, but it was him that was ahead. And it was him that was running ahead when the safety car came, which meant that he was the one that was pitted and Lando was the one that stayed out. And that ended up being the best way to run the race. Finished a very solid fourth there. He would have been closer to Leclerc had he not been stuck behind Lewis Hamilton's long-running Mercedes for so long. But he's absolutely on target to be at Norris's level at least in going into his second season. I think that's quite something if he can achieve that. And then if McLaren, as the season goes on, if they can develop the car. I think it would be impressive if they were able to put as much performance on it as they did last year. But, we don't know. So I think really it's in the hands of the car more than him. He's doing absolutely the job that's expected of him. And he's to be at that level in just your second season, I think, is very, very impressive.
Yeah, it's a really interesting battle to see how that evolves, him and Norris. Who's going to end up being quicker? We know Norris is very quick, but could Piastri ultimately become quicker? And then how Piastri gets on in terms of all the wider aspects of the game, because Norris is a very adaptable, very capable driver. He's got a lot to offer, so that's a fascinating battle. How's Oscar seen in Australia, Michael? Is he now the Australian great hope? Have people really taken to him?
In the last, I would say, maybe 6 to 8 months, his profile's rocketed enormously. This time last year, it was much smaller. He was still had the baggage, I suppose, of the way he arrived at McLaren, which was via the exit door opened by Daniel Ricciardo.
Well, he was almost the bad guy down here, wasn't
he?
Well,
exactly right, yeah. And I think a lot of people didn't appreciate... A lot of people really had some bad feelings about McLaren more than anything else. They felt like Daniel had been treated quite harshly. They felt like maybe Mark Webber, who manages Oscar Piastri, had some kind of hand in the whole situation beyond just doing the signature stuff, I suppose. But once people started to realise that he was a talented guy, who was living up to the hype that got him there in the first place, thinking particularly Silverstone, that was almost, much like he describes that as the light switch for his own season, I think it was really a light switch for a lot of people here to understand that actually we've got something here. And I mean, the rest of that season for him was also really good, so people were really drawn to his story from that point to the point now where if you see the few advertisements in Melbourne for the race, they don't need to advertise much since there are no tickets left to be sold. He's front and centre now. Well, even last year, when Daniel Ricciardo was not on the grid, he was sort of the number one character being advertised, which is kind of ridiculous when you think about it. This year, it has sort of corrected itself to being the leading Australian driver, leading the campaign of the Australian Grand Prix, if you like. And that's really good because I think that helps him come out of his shell a little bit. Last year, he was really quite reserved compared to the way he normally is. I was speaking to him over the off-season, and even then, you could tell he was feeling much more comfortable with himself as a Formula One driver, I think. The confidence boost of late last year really made him feel like he belonged there. I think that was even, in fact, his words to me, that he feels like he really belongs like a Formula One driver in the last 6 months of last season. And I think that will only endear him further to the Australian fans, because as much as I think he's won them over, that spectre of Daniel Ricciardo being the ideal Australian athlete, if you like, still hangs over a little bit. But, I mean, performance at the end of the day is what Australians like to see, and I think that'll do the talking.
Yeah, they're certainly very different personalities. But if I was to go out onto the street, not speaking to people who are here for the race, how well known is Oscar Piastri? Is he turning up on normal television, for want of a better word? Is he a star name? Obviously, he's not in the upper echelons of Australian athletes in terms of what he's achieving, simply because there's so many extraordinarily successful sports people in this part of the world. But is he becoming a household name beyond people who are F1 fans?
He's becoming. He's not at the Daniel Ricciardo level yet, but I think part of that is simply tenure. He's really only been around for 1 year, wasn't featured extensively in Drive to Survive. I know we don't always like to talk about that being the basis of Formula One fandom, but that is sort of a big part of it. But it is growing, undoubtedly. You know, the fact that he is front and center on television advertising and all that kind of thing, he is growing. And the fact that Formula One has a greater awareness generally means that your general public that may not even be interested in coming to the race do have this growing background awareness of, oh, he's one of ours, if you like.
It's interesting, isn't it, Mark? Because Oscar Piastri's character, as we said, is very different to Ricciardo, but he's a very focused individual as well, isn't he? He works very hard, he gets into the detail, and I think he's someone who gives the impression of being very in control of what he's doing as well. There's not much overexcitement, shall we say, around him. He goes about his business in a very professional way, which is quite a big strength, isn't it?
Yeah, he's very laid back, very cool, very calm, and that's just his whole persona. And as we've all got to know him a bit better, there is an underlying humour behind it all as well. He is actually quite personable, but yeah, his whole approach is incredibly calm, and you hear it on the radio as well. There's very little excitement whether he's done well. There's very little apparent depression when things haven't gone well. It's just, you know, focus. Okay, if we've done well, we've ticked the box. If we haven't done well, there's something we need to work on here. And that's all you're getting. You're just getting this constant striving, this constant focus on performance. And he's very, very impressive.
Well, I thought that Qatar sprint win last year, not a Grand Prix win, but a sprint win when he had Verstappen pressuring him, I thought showed very good ability, because that's the sort of situation where it is easy to get a little bit distracted and not focus on the job in hand, and that's always the big challenge. But interested to see how McLaren get on this weekend. This track's been reasonably good to them in recent years, and they do, as we discussed, fluctuate with the track characteristics. But I thought Saudi Arabia was a really interesting example of McLaren's struggles, because the track mixes things the car's brilliant at. The first sector, Lando Norris had the fastest first sector time in the race, but then you've got those two long slow corners, turn 10 I think it is, and the last one turn 27, which is where they really struggle, because that car, when it's in a reasonable amount of your aerodynamics, just does not work as well. And it's interesting to hear Andrea Stella, the team principals, talking about in the first third of the season, maybe around race five or six, so Miami, Imola time, they should have some upgrades, front wing and a few associated things that will improve that. But he's still talking about it being at least a 1 year journey to get to the point where they have an all round strong car. But they should also still have a car that's very, very strong at tracks like Suzuka, which we go to after Melbourne. So that's pretty interesting. Michael, do you think that Oscar's in a position to grab a win at some stage this year? A proper win, should we say, a Grand Prix win on a track that's well suited to the McLaren? So tracks like Suzuka, Qatar, Silverstone, the high speed ones.
Yeah, I think he certainly will be, because we've seen that progression over the course of last year. And I think the sprint win, okay, not the proper win that everyone wants it to be, but is sort of, I guess, one third of the journey, right? Is it one third of the distance? But I think, sort of, Mark was saying earlier, the big challenge for him is managing tyres. And if we think about most of the tracks that McLaren should go well at, that is also a major component of performance at those circuits. Think about Suzuka last year, was one of his most competitive Grand Prix, but was way behind Lando Norris because the tyres were such a major factor in race performance there. So I'm just trying to think now, but most of those tracks seem to correlate with quite high tyre demand. So that's going to be the real test. I think if he can overcome Lando Norris at one of those tracks, that's a tremendous sign of that trajectory more than anything else, because it'll sort of be all of the stars aligning for his performance. But I think podium certainly should be on the cards. Like, we think about Australia this weekend, which probably is going to be similar to Saudi in terms of the way the McLaren will be maybe just behind the podium battle. But a race that doesn't put a massive premium on the tyres should be a track where he has an opportunity to at least score those podiums. And then, yeah, we see maybe Suzuka is coming too early for all those stars to align, like we were saying. But I think by the end of the year, we should see him be in that frame.
And the tyre management side is still inconclusive, isn't it, Mark? Because Bahrain's a slightly odd one. Yes, it's very tyre management dependent, but it's a very specific kind of tyre management in terms of those traction zones in particular. And then Jeddah's not really a tyre management circuit with the tyres that Pirelli brings. So it's not really been tested in anger. I'm sure he will have taken a step, but Norris is very good at that sort of thing.
Yeah, he's one of the very best at that. And it's a very subtle skill, and it's to do with just, you know, translating the feel to what your knowledge is of what's going on. And you can be guided to an extent by your race engineer, because they're monitoring the tyre temperatures, and that's basically what it's about, not letting the tyres get too hot, because as soon as they do get too hot, they've lost the performance forever. That's it. You know, it doesn't matter how much rubber they've still got left on them. And that's that mixture of feel and experience, and Lando is very, very good at it. And Bahrain's all about managing the rear tyres. It's much more balanced at Jeddah and Albert Park. It's between the front and rear axles, and they're not particularly hard on tyre deg, and you're not struggling with excess temperatures so much. So, yeah, we're not going to see it here, but we will definitely see it in Suzuka. That's going to be the first real litmus test for him in that.
Yeah, it's going to be an acid test for McLaren as well to see how strong they're going to be. I still think it's going to take a little bit of luck for them to get a win, because there's getting a win on merit by beating Max Verstappen and Red Bull, and there's getting a win because you're best of the rest and Max Verstappen's hit trouble and maybe Checo Perez isn't there. So, yeah, still a bit of a long way for McLaren, a bit longer than they would like, but they're still on the right trajectory. And I think over the next couple of seasons, we'll see them moving into that sphere, and then 26 is the absolute key for them. And while we're on Australian things, Michael, how's Daniel Ricciardo's progress being received in Australia? We spoke last week on this podcast about his performance level not really justifying his candidacy for promotion to Red Bull. So has his star waned here as Piastri's has risen?
I've been surprised how much it seems to have waned, in fact. It's not just last year, but certainly the first two races of this year, there have been many more people. It's sort of anecdotal. It's responses to things we've been writing and things like that. But there have been many more people willing to doubt Daniel Ricciardo, which in the past would have been grounds for your citizenship to be revoked, to be honest. The fact that people are so extreme, maybe not say extreme, but are so willing to be critical of Daniel Ricciardo is really interesting. There's a definite change from even 12 months ago, when people still felt he'd been hard done by McLaren. I'm seeing much less of that and much more of people willing to believe maybe he's either over the hill or past it or whatever. And even potentially, there are quite a few people who are big fans of Liam Lawson as an example, and think that it's Daniel who's holding him up, which I guess to an extent he is. That's been very interesting to me. I think a lot of the criticism is probably a little bit heavy. I heard you guys talking about it last week and Helmut Marko's comments that he needs to find something soon. And, you know, it was a little bit early from Helmut Marko, admittedly, but not entirely wrong. He has been bested by Yuki Tsunoda in the first two races of the season. But I think there will be more to come from Daniel. I think we've seen enough to know that there is more there than we've seen the first two rounds. But the ultimate question is whether there is enough to mount an argument that he can get back towards those front-running teams. People want to see him in a car that has the opportunity to definitively prove whether he can still be a race winner. But it's been surprising to me how willing people have been to doubt him in recent months.
I guess it comes from just the long duration of his struggles, doesn't it? In that you can put it all down to McLaren. The McLaren was a weird car. It was a difficult car to drive, even before the rule changes. The 21 car was peculiar, as Ricciardo put it. And Lando Norris has talked about that. Carlos Sainz before him has talked about that as well. So there's no doubt that it is a tricky car. But then getting into the AlphaTauri as it was last year, the RB as it is this year, people are expecting him to be beating Yuki Tsunoda. And I would say, on balance, Tsunoda has been the quicker AlphaTauri driver, RB driver, whatever you want to call it, over the past year or so, or however many months it is. But of course, it's been interrupted for Ricciardo.
Yeah.
So I guess there's still time, isn't there, for him to really settle in and show if he can do it. But if he can't beat Tsunoda, he surely is going to struggle to get into a Red Bull racing seat, even as a capable number two.
I think so. And I think there's also another underlying question there, which is that the first year of McLaren, like you say, very much about this unusual car, whatever it was, didn't match his driving style. We now don't have a baseline for his performance in this era of regulations, whether he has some kind of fundamental mismatch to just the way these cars want to be driven. On paper, you wouldn't have thought so. And on paper, you would also think he's a good enough driver that even if he has a weakness with this regulation, he shouldn't be so off the pace. You know, we've seen what he's capable of at Red Bull Racing when things are sort of working in his favor. But as long as he is not convincing, that remains a live question. So even if we get to the end of the year and he's done a, you know, a reasonably good job, whatever we might want to describe that as, there will still be that question mark of, even if we put him in a very competitive car, are there just going to be off days for him where at certain tracks where this car is not super happy, is he just going to be missing in a way that he didn't used to be? So I think there's a lot more riding on him, as everyone sort of talked about so far this year, because he needs a much bigger performance than Yuki Tsunoda to make this season a success.
He feels like a driver, Mark, who has been extremely good, but as the prevailing conditions in F1 have shifted, it's kind of moved away from him. We tend to think of these drivers, well, I like to call them kind of number one and a half drivers, in that when things are right, they can be brilliant. And he was stunningly good. 2014 and 2016 in particular stand out as outstanding seasons for him. You can argue he was the best driver in both of those seasons out of everyone on the grid, certainly right up there. But it does feel like it's drifted away from him a little bit. He adapted very well to the demands of the old F1 cars, if you want to put it that way. These are very, very different. And it just feels like he's still grasping a little bit for it. He's not slow, but that edge, I don't know whether it's really accessible to him.
Yeah, and the longer it goes on, the more of a worry it becomes. I mean, one thing about Daniel, he's always capable of springing a surprise. And, you know, it would be totally in character that he turns up to a race one weekend and is just on it and everybody thinks, oh, he's back. But it's a question of sustaining it. I mean, he did that second row qualifying in Mexico last year, for example. But, I don't think he's got his head around in terms of what you have to do in the car automatically without thinking about it. I don't think he's got his head around it ever since leaving Renault. I mean, people remember his Red Bull career and say he should never have left there. That's easy to say. And there's a perception that he hasn't been the same driver since, but I'd argue that in his 2 years at Renault, he's absolutely at the level he'd been at Red Bull. He came into what was Nico Hülkenberg's team, who's no idiot, and just took it off him by sheer performance, just blew him off. So, and then did the same to Esteban Ocon the following year. So I don't think there was anything wrong with his performances then. It's just the McLaren, which exaggerated the unusual demands, and then he's just it's as though that's got him in such a downward spiral that he's not been able to find his way out. And I think if he's got a weakness as a driver, Daniel, it's that he's not very technically minded, and maybe when you're talking about incorporating something in your driving to an extent where it's muscle memory and you do the right thing automatically rather than have to think about it, I think in some cases you do need a little bit of a technical understanding to put together in your head why you've got to brake in this way and come off the brakes in this way and steer in this way, because you're understanding the physics behind it and it forms a picture in your head. And then once you've grasped onto that picture, then your body starts to do the right things. And I don't think he's ever had that. It's all been very, very instinctive, and it obviously it dovetailed very well before his McLaren days with what was required. He's how old now?
34.
34. Sounds right. You know, you come to mind, the old dog's new tricks comes to mind, and it's been going on a while now, and yeah, two races into the season and Yuki's definitely been the quicker driver, and by quite a worrying amount at the last round at Jeddah. It was about half a second in qualifying.
I think also on that, I think underestimated in Daniel's game is that he's a tremendous confidence driver. And that's been hidden by the fact that things did come naturally, like you're describing, at Red Bull Racing. And I'm glad you mentioned Renault, because too many people neglect that the Renault years were actually quite good, quite strong.
He had like three or four difficult races adapting, and then he got there and was performing at a very high level.
Yeah, it was really good,
He was incredible at Spa.
But that spiral element, I think, is what also concerns me, because at McLaren, it definitely became a matter of confidence. He's talked quite a lot about, he didn't realise until after he left how down on himself he was in those years, and that really contributed to the massive tail off in the last 6 months in particular of his McLaren tenure. He's arrived back at Red Bull with a lot of confidence. He feels at home. You know, we've heard him talk about this a lot. But if he can't get to grasp of this quickly, I'm a little bit worried that actually we'll see that again, where he doubts himself again. And then from that point, without any more cards to play about returning to this team or making this contract decision, it's harder to recover that confidence. So I think a big result could change things for him quite dramatically if he has that potential yet to be realised. But I think if it goes on for too long, then confidence really does start to become a factor with him.
Yeah, I think he's certainly been able to modify his outlook and approach because, as you say, in that McLaren period, it was very difficult. And even quite early on, when you'd speak to him about trying to adapt and he'd talk about trying to have a counterintuitive driving style, he admitted that he wasn't completely on top of the technical side. So he's really putting effort in. And I think he's probably realised on the point you were talking about, Mark, having that technical underpinning, it was all a little bit too late for him to start properly filling up those data banks and understanding it. So he's realised he's got to lean back on his traditional strengths. And so I think his outlook and his approach since he's come back with this team have changed. But whether that means he can make it all really come together, he's been perfectly decent, but only in flashes have we seen anything really, really impressive. But I guess the last point on him is, how is his journey seen in Australia? Is he regarded as the idiot who gave it all up at Red Bull to go off chasing his $25 million a year at Renault as he was paid? Or do people kind of give him a break for that sort of thing and think, well, he had his reasons for moving on and it's just not worked for him?
I think most people have forgotten he went to Renault, to be honest with you. So I don't know if that's necessarily what it's thought of. But there is a little bit of that. But I think people do just genuinely remember the good times at Red Bull. And that, I think the underlying assumption with a lot of people as they come to terms with either a post-Daniel Ricciardo world or the twilight of his career, however we might want to describe it, with him just tailing off more than having made bad decisions. The money thing hasn't really come into it, which is a little bit interesting. Like, Australians love cutting down tall poppies. It's a big part of the national cultural identity, but it hasn't really got to him in that way. So I think it's really up to him to decide how this final chapter will be regarded at home domestically. I think there was a degree of people thinking maybe he was joking around a little bit too much as his performances were tailing off. I don't necessarily share that opinion, but he has a chance to define how he'll be remembered if these are his final years, in fact. I think a lot of people will hope that they're not. And then we'll see, I guess, how nationally he's regarded as a sporting hero who maybe didn't quite live up. Well, maybe not live up to the potential. Didn't get the results perhaps his potential deserved.
Yeah, it's a shame he never got into a title-challenging car during his pomp, because he was very, very good that middle part of the 2010s. Some really outstanding performances. I'm not sure whether Australia is the best hunting ground for him to hit form, given it's not always been great for him, but we'll see how he gets on this weekend.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at armorall.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Right, Mark, let's look ahead to the race itself now. Max Verstappen and Red Bull, clear favourites, unless you want to make a slightly mad case for why they're not. But that battle behind will be closer. Can you see any chance of a return, at least to pole position, challenging form from Ferrari? Because, of course, Charles Leclerc could have been on pole in Bahrain, certainly.
Yeah, I mean, he could have been. He did a quicker time in Q2 than Verstappen's pole, so that tells you he could have done it. Is this sort of track where he might be able to repeat that sort of form? I'm not sure it is. It looked from the picture in Jeddah that the Red Bull is a much more aero-efficient car. When you look at the time it was pulling out down the straights on the Ferrari, given that that this track is now, you know, since it was altered, is now very much an aero-efficiency track, a lot of flat-out running, I think it would be a little bit of a struggle. The one thing that might bring Verstappen within reach in qualifying is if it's cooler than expected. It still has that trait, I think, of you don't always know that the tyres are fully there in turn one, because you might not have gotten fully up to temperature. And that's what made it a bit iffy last year against, it was against the Mercedes last year. The Mercedes was the quick car around here last year. But even so, no, I think realistically this is Verstappen all the way. It'd be interesting to see the Ferrari versus Mercedes comparison here, because I don't think the corners are so fast here that they should be triggering the bouncing problems that the Mercedes was having in Jeddah, in which case this layout is quite good for the traits that we've seen on that car. So I think the Mercedes-Ferrari comparison might be interesting.
Yeah, Mercedes... Obviously, Saudi was really tricky for them. What do you make of what they're doing, Michael? Obviously, everything was quite positive in testing and in Bahrain. Yeah, we've eliminated our long-standing problems. And then you had this high-speed rear instability problem, lack of confidence, particularly for Lewis Hamilton, that reared its head in Jeddah. It felt a little bit like the complaints of the previous years, which is a bit worrying.
Yeah, a little bit dispiriting, I think, for Mercedes fans, or probably more to the point, Mercedes drivers. I think what's most concerning about it, I suppose, is not simply just that it's the problems that feel very familiar, but now there's this idea, well, actually, maybe the tools we've been using for the last 3 years are a part of the issue. We're not getting, as I think Toto Wolff was saying, the downforce numbers, the performance characteristics we expected through these corners based on simulation and wind tunnel and that kind of stuff, which again sort of just takes us back to this idea that, you know, last year we're saying, well, they were 1 year behind and maybe they've got time to reset, and then we're saying, well, now they've lost 2 years but might be time to take wins before the end of the regulations. Now we're possibly facing the idea, well, actually the last 3 years, because of the tools they've been using, their understanding of the way they've been going about building this car, if they've been fundamentally wrong, and I use the word fundamental because that was Toto Wolff's words, then where does the recovery start? You know, we've still got 1 year of these regulations, which is fine, but that year is going to be really crucial to 2026. Is there confidence in that team that actually the methodology they've been using to design this car won't also problem the 2026 car? Because if that's the case, then we're talking about exponential problems about Mercedes getting back to that, the front-running position the team believes it deserves to be. So I think that is almost more concerning. Interesting, Andy Shovelin has said that practice in Melbourne is going to be all about experimentation to try and understand that. There are maybe one or two corners that might simulate some of the problems in Saudi Arabia in Melbourne, but even then it's one track. I know we love to say Albert Park is an outlier of a track. There are 24 now, so there are a lot of outliers, but I think it's the sooner they can understand it, the more confidence it'll inspire. But I think confidence must feel pretty low at the start of a third year of very similar issues.
Yeah, they certainly eliminated a lot of the problems, but still this question persists, doesn't it, Mark, about their understanding when the floor's really low to the ground. Gary Anderson did a good piece on the race website, our resident XF1 technical director. You can find that. It's under the headline, Gary Anderson, What Mercedes Still Can't Get Right in This F1 Era. And not only does that have some excellent Gary explanation, but it has lots of graphs in it as well. So there's some good detail there. But it does just seem that there's things under this rule set that they're finding very, very difficult to understand. And simulation's obviously a big part of that, using all the different simulation tools, that's wind tunnel, CFD, and a lot more other besides. But it gets very complicated, and they've spent a lot of time working on improving the tools. It's not like they've suddenly got to this point and thought, oh, maybe we should look at this. A couple of years, they've been sinking a huge amount of resources into getting on top of this, and still there's these question marks.
Yeah, and it all seems to be pitched around where they put the right height of the aerodynamic map. And in the first year, before anybody considered really the possibility of bouncing and porpoising, they went really aggressive in terms of where they pitched the right height map of the car. And in the wind tunnel, the numbers were fantastic and had those numbers translated into real life. probably nobody else would have won a race. but it was fantasy, as it turned out, because of the limitations of bouncing. So there was clearly something fundamental in that first year that they'd not considered, and that had an impact on the entire concept of the car. Now, they believed for last year that what they needed to do was just re-optimize the aerodynamic map a little bit higher up the scale so as to avoid that problematical area where you're very prone to the bouncing phenomenon. And with a few changes to the rear suspension, give it a bit more travel, it would that would cure the problem, and you'd be able to start accessing some of the really good high-speed downforce of the concept. And it turned out they were too conservative with where they'd pitched the ride height map, and they went that whole new car that it was introduced in Monaco wasn't really about the side pods. That was just a box tick to keep Toto Wolff and Lewis Hamilton happy. It was actually the reconfiguring the underfloor in a way that got it away from that over-conservative approach that they'd taken going into this car. So they'd gone over centre. They'd reacted in the opposite way in reaction to the problems of 22. And so we come into this year with a completely reconfigured car. The cockpit's moved back to a more conventional position. They've done a floor that they feel would allow them to be more aggressive once more with where you pitch the ride height, and that they should now have a good enough understanding that they'd be able to do it this time. And Jeddah, the reason Jeddah was so troubling was it suggested, no, you haven't. You've still got that same underlying problem. So it just gives all the indications of a team that's just not quite got its head around yet the really tricky trade-off of this regulation set is. And, just from observation of the cars that have gone well and why they've gone well, it looks like you can't be chasing the ultimate downforce. And certainly high-speed downforce is relatively easy to get because the cars, the exponential increase in the underbody grip as it comes down close to the floor. But it's how much grip you have as the ride height comes up at slow speeds, and it's very easy to lose an awful lot of downforce in those conditions at slow speeds. And so it's getting that compromise right. And it's no good finding out that it's wrong in race two of the season. You know, this needs to be something that's discovered in the conception stage of the car. So that's why Jeddah last week was so troubling.
And it is difficult. It's not easy to do this. That's why there are so many cars out there that have this kind of split. Some are better at the high ride heights. Some are better at the lower ride heights. It's quite hard to get into that position where you're running well across the board. Ferrari seems to have taken a good step in that direction this year, which is why that car looks quite encouraging. They seem to be in the place where they can keep working and just adding performance to that car without troubleshooting, which is encouraging. It's just a question of them doing it faster than Red Bull. Michael, we should have Carlos Sainz back this weekend. He has been in Melbourne since the start of the week. Obviously, he had the appendicitis and the surgery, so that recovery complicates things, but good to have him back. Bit of a shame Ollie Bearman won't be in the car, given the impression he made, but he'll be back in F2 action and presumably he's on standby as well. So looking forward to seeing Sainz back. We're a bit disappointed we can't see how the 18-year-old gets on.
It feels harsh to say disappointed when it's because he wouldn't have recovered from his appendectomy, but it is a little bit of a shame in the sense that we got this great little glimpse of Ollie Bearman, and then to see what he can do with the full preparation, let's say, would have been really exciting. But I think the Carlos Sainz story is also very exciting, because when we found out he was going to lose his drive at Ferrari, it became really a matter of just doing a good enough job to find himself at another front-running team, which is, I guess, still fundamentally the question. But it feels like the driver market has become so enlivened in the last even 3 weeks that it almost feels like you can take nothing for a given at this point. And suddenly it's a gross exaggeration to say he's racing for his career, but he's racing for a first option, I suppose, next season, when there could be any number of drivers suddenly, highly sought after drivers, suddenly competing with him for the spot he wants. And he's been consistently good against Charles Leclerc in their tenure at Ferrari. Charles had that edge in qualifying inevitably, but by no means a horrific margin that really puts Sainz in the shade. And he's also always been a really to use his phrase, I suppose, a smooth operator in the race. Can't believe my brain went first to that phrase. So I'm really excited to see what he can do. So I think that storyline is enough for me to not feel too bad that he's recovered in a timely manner from his operation.
He's in such a curious position, isn't he, Mark? Because Sainz has been dropped by Ferrari, not really because he was failing in that seat at all, but because they wanted Lewis Hamilton. You can understand that. And he's in this scenario where he's in demand in that there's a lot of teams interested in him and a lot of places where he could do well. But there's nowhere that looks like a cast iron guarantee that can keep him at the front. So if you're in his position, you'd be a bit worried, wouldn't you? Because you run the risk of being everybody's second, third or fourth choice. And then suddenly you're no one's first choice. And,
it could happen.
And you go from a Ferrari to, it's not completely impossible to be without a decent driver. I think that's very unlikely, but he could end up with a big downturn in his career, not entirely through his own fault. Obviously, had he been consistently quicker than Charles Leclerc, that would have changed things. Mm. But he's performed at a good level.
Yeah, I think we're not going to know for a while yet. And because there's so much up in the air in terms of what's happening at Red Bull, you would have said before, it's probably depending on what Mercedes decides to do, which will put everything else into place. But that's actually, even that's now obsolete, given what we've seen going on at Red Bull and the uncertainty surrounding future lineup there. So I think, we could be a long, long way into the season before we even know what realistic options he has. In theory, there's a seat at Red Bull, there's a seat at Mercedes. There might be a seat at Aston Martin, depending on what Fernando Alonso chooses to do. After that, he's probably got a rock-solid option at Audi or Sauber Audi, whatever it'll be called next year. He's not going to be without a drive, but he's not at the stage in his career where he can be looking at 2 or 3 years building a new project. That's not where he needs to be. He needs to be in a car which has at least got an outside chance of winning races. It's going to be contending for victories. And I think he'll probably end up in one of those seats. But which one at the moment, I've no idea.
There's a lot of moving parts in that driver market. Obviously, you alluded to the Red Bull situation with Verstappen. We've got a long way into this podcast without having to talk about that at all. But, Michael, we should bring you in on this in your role as the Australian view. How's that story been received in this part of the world? Is it as huge here as it's been everywhere else?
It's dominated. It's doing numbers. This will mean nothing if you're not Australian, but doing AFL and NRL numbers on most news websites, which is ludicrous because technically nothing has happened other than people talking to him and maybe leaking some messages allegedly. So it is a huge story, and I mean it speaks to the fact that everyone knows the Red Bull. If you know Formula One, you know the Red Bull's the top team, you know Max Verstappen is. There is that Daniel Ricciardo element in there, but I think they stand on their own. So it is an enormous story. And the idea, I think it's the, and it must be the same everywhere, the idea that this super successful relationship could end for reasons at least not publicly known, for motivations unclear, is an enrapturing story. It makes no sense. And it's the kind of story that people are interested in because it's also a great story where people can speculate aimlessly and mindlessly about. And that's perfectly fine when there's that vacuum of information, I suppose. So it is an enormous story. And yeah, if it really does translate into Max potentially putting himself on the market, I mean, that just sort of blows up everything. In a season which we probably won't have too much to talk about other than off-track things, a good driver market is very exciting.
I think as Toto Wolff said, any team boss would do handstands to get Max Verstappen in their car. But it is extraordinary. And of course, Mark, we've seen more developments recently with the complainants appealed against what's happened. There's talk of having lodged complaints with the FIA. So it's just not stopping, is it? And it's going to keep happening in one way, shape or form. Not even just this specific case, but the wider political battle that we've talked about.
Yeah, it's not over. The story's not over yet. We're at an uneasy truce at the moment. That's what we came out of Jeddah with after the CEO had sat down separately with Helmut Marko and Christian Horner, and they confirmed that they were both still in their positions and everything would be moving forward and let's draw a line under it and move on. But of course, that's easy to wish for. It's not under their control whether that happens. And so, yeah, I think this how it pans out could well take a good while yet because the legal processes that are probably going to end up being invoked after. I think the appeal against the decision is the first step of what will become a full-on legal process. And so then we might see a greater impact upon, what's a tenable position for Red Bull and for partners and future partners, Ford in particular. So, the questions that this whole thing blew up in the first place all those weeks ago are still there, regardless of what's happened in the meantime and what the Red Bull management is saying. It's still up in the air. Those questions are still exactly the same questions.
And of course, for all the talk about the wider political battles, which of course are significant, the key is that the processes and the legal side and the original complaints and everything are all treated correctly. That's the absolute number one priority ultimately. But yeah, there's lots and lots of different agendas and different factions involved in this one, which is pretty remarkable. Meanwhile, on track they keep winning, but obviously, Michael, it's very easy for them to say, well, there's no distraction, we're still doing well. But obviously this sort of thing can have a long-term impact, can't it? When you see this bit of unraveling, it wouldn't be today you'd see the on-track manifestation of any impact from this. It would be down the years ultimately, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, there are two elements to it. There is the somewhat more immediate, or let's say maybe by the end of the year element, which is that if the two factions or three factions continue to war, then some people within the race team are going to see the Verstappen camp as undermining the team more generally, even if it's mostly Jos who's doing it, at least publicly, then that can... I mean, not there's a lot you can do to destabilize Max, considering by the end of the year he's probably going to have the thing sewn up, but there is that element. But then there is the second element, as Mark was sort of saying, if this does... If the investigation component is drawn out and the appeal process becomes a legal process, then it does become a matter of, well, you have Christian Horner who has proclaimed that he is innocent, he's insisted that he's innocent, will presumably continue to do that, but then can he remain in that role if he's also before the courts? But then do you hold that position for him, in which case you have a really temporary hold on the way the team operates, and then you're into the really crucial next season when we're talking about 2026. And I think that's... The risk is that this doesn't get resolved, I think, is the bigger thing. More than it rumbling on, or more than it perhaps staining the reputation of the team, whatever, from the competitive aspect anyway, putting aside the fact that this is starting from a really serious place, it is that if this just is not resolved, then the team can't really move forward competitively. Yeah, they're lucky they're at sort of the top of the mountain now, but that they can't stay there if things sort of stall.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the simple fact is we go into this weekend expecting something or other to flare up or be talked about or someone to say something. I don't believe Jos is in Melbourne for this one. I don't think he's going to be around until perhaps Miami might be his next race. I think he's missing this run of events. Obviously, he was doing a rally on Saudi Grand Prix weekend. So, I mean, he still said some stuff in Belgium ultimately. So, yeah, that's that's going to keep happening ultimately. We're going to try and focus on what's going on track, but off track's been so all-consuming almost this year, it's impossible to ignore. Well, thanks very much to Michael and Mark for your insight. Head to therace.com to read all of our coverage of the Australian Grand Prix weekend. Remember to check out the Race Members Club if you'd like to join. Lots of extra F1 content if you join. And of course, you get to ask your questions to us in our Race Review podcast. And you can also join by Apple Podcast as well as by the link in the description to this podcast. And I've listened to our other podcast, Bring Back V10s, the Race F1 Tech Show with Gary Anderson. Also, have a look our YouTube channel. Right, we're going to be heading to the circuit imminently, so stay with us for everything you need to know from the world of Formula One.
The Athletic.